Welcome, every however many people are there listening.
Oh, are we starting?
Yeah, let's just start.
All right, can I get a kick drum beat?
Yeah. You want a drum roll or just a drum beat?
I've had way too much bread today, but thanks.
Okay, here's a glass of water.
There's the sound I'm looking for.
Okay.
Rich,
well, what are
full body.
What are we welcoming people to today?
Well, if you've happened to stumble upon this audio experiment, then you've stumbled upon Making the Grade, the incredible, insightful, and brilliant new podcast starring myself, Peter Charbonneau.
And myself, Jonathan Zemsky.
And his self, and we selves. And basically what we're going to talk about are things that make the grade. And it's going to be a lot of pop culture. There's going to be some music. There's going to be maybe some video games, maybe little comic books. Whatever strikes our fancy, hopefully strikes your fancy. And
Marbles.
Yeah, Fancy
like
Feast.
Marbles.
We'll talk.
No, I mean them.
Oh.
Like playing with marbles.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk.
Those are fancy.
We're going to have
some of them.
A special 16-part series on marbles. So you don't want to miss it.
You ever heard of the cat's eye?
No, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, don't jump into that.
Okay,
just
yeah,
yet.
We don't want
right.
to
right.
yeah. we don't want to spoil too much because next thing you know, we're shooting to the top of the Apple iTunes podcast list, and we kind of want this to be a slow, gradual build that's going to take about 18 to 20 years. So
yeah.
You can say you were there first.
So what are we going to talk about this week on Making the Grade?
Well, we're going to start probably the only place we possibly could start, and that's with the 1987 Martin Cove vehicle, Steel Justice.
Oh, yes. That's a great idea.
Not to get off on too many tangents, but let's start off with a tangent here. But the phrase, you know, Martin Cove vehicle, it implies that this was something that was going to transport Martin Cove, actor best known as Sensei John Kreese in The Karate Kid, to something. And I think it's safe to say that if Steel Justice was meant to transport him somewhere, Steel Justice was a car with four flat tires.
Yeah, so like, was Karate Kid to him, I mean, Karate Kid was a huge, huge movie, but was Karate Kid to him kind of like the mini electric car that he was taking to the train, then to a bus, then to some kind of, like, the Concorde?
Yeah,
I mean,
think
trying to
Karate,
follow what
Karate
you're...
Kid was probably a limo service
mm-hmm.
that someone else hired to pick him up, to take
yep.
him to the airport, that
okay.
was going to fly him to parts unknown to
mm-hmm.
get into another car, which was essentially going to be the vehicle that would become Steel Justice, that was going to take him to his next great acting height.
Yeah, so now I understand. I mean
it's,
you know,
it's pretty simple.
Yeah, we have listeners here that want to really understand what we're talking about when we see a vehicle, so that totally makes
if
sense.
If you visit our website, the name of which escapes me because it's not created yet, you'll see a handy infographic really kind of mapping out this whole phenomenon.
Sounds great. All right, so Steel Justice, we have Martin Cove. There's a couple questions I'd like to answer today, some of which are, is it okay to be shirtless at the beach with a pink sweater around your neck while sitting on a child's swing? Is that okay?
If your name is Martin Cove and you're acting in Steel Justice, the answer to that is an unequivocal yes. And
and
you can even throw in exercising with a mop on the beach
mm-hmm,
to that
mm-hmm.
Scenario, and and the answer would still be yes.
Yeah, and the other question I want answered is a snake wearing a snake a fashion statement, or is a snake a mascot or an ascot?
I think the only person that could possibly answer that question would be the snake itself, and I really
mm-hmm.
wish we could. We're going to delve into that, I think.
Yeah, yeah,
because
I'm
I think
jumping
that's
ahead a little
huge,
bit.
That is a
yeah.
huge something to do with Steel Justice
yes.
as a whole.
It is.
And this movie is just, for lack of a better term, it is just batshit crazy. This movie is like people got in a room and they had this great idea of, like, let's put every possible 80s action movie trope into this, and how can it go wrong? And yet it still goes, I would say, spectacularly wrong. There's even a music video in the middle of this for really no reason whatsoever other than to get the the dancers and the band shot and killed.
Well, in the 80s also, you have to have a leotard dance scene in an action film. Am I correct? I mean, you have to have a leotard scene.
You know, sure. I mean, First Blood Part 2 had several.
Mm-hmm. And so somebody, the person who wrote this film clearly watched Rambo. The question is, what kind of state were they in when the movie was on? Because they pretty much got it all wrong.
I'm going to guess Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. I'm going to have to analyze that later. But so, I mean, you know, they definitely used the 80s action film genre, big muscles, shirtless, you know, formula here. But it just went south in a hurry and did not work out. So what do you want to talk about Steel Justice? We got to get people interested in seeing this film.
Sure.
If I can call it film.
Why don't we give like a really super brief, just basic recap.
Yes.
And we should preface this by saying, although we grew up and are products of the 80s, neither John nor I saw this movie until, I would say, probably about 3 years ago. So, and judging by the box office, no one else did either. And
yeah.
it would be our life's mission to actually find someone that saw this movie in the theater. And if we can bring that interview to you and to ourselves, I would probably die a mostly happy person.
Yeah, and I mean, if we could get one person to watch this movie just because we talked about it, that would be great. And then they can donate, you know, money to Martin Cove, and maybe he can go make a better movie or pick a different career. I don't know, do something.
And we should also say that I unabashedly love this movie because it's so. This would fall firmly into the category of so bad it's good.
Oh my goodness, this is almost the bar that we've learned to use in the past few years for so bad it's good.
And John and I, this is our second go at the first episode of our podcast. The first time we tried to get into talking about Steel Justice, we literally were talking for 6 weeks straight. We could not stop.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie is, you know, I'm going to say clocks in at about an hour and 45 minutes. So there's just so much going on, and most of it is absolutely incredible or incredibly bad. So, John, you want to give a basic plot as to what the hell's going on in Steel Justice here?
Yeah, Steel Justice is a film about a decorated war veteran. I mean, that's pretty much it, right? I mean, is that good enough?
I'm not even sure how decorated he is.
Oh, yeah. All right, let me back up a little bit.
I mean, he's decorated with, like, a snake around his neck.
Yeah, and no shirt and a lot of filth. He has a lot of filth on him.
He's a dirty guy. I mean,
yeah,
like,
he is a dirty
physically,
guy.
He looks like he lives in mud.
You're much better at like sequencing and putting together thoughts and ideas than I am. I'll go out on a some kind of tangent about what kind of trees and shrubs were in the opening scene. So maybe you should kind of rein me in a little bit. Just give a very brief synopsis, if you will, of what in the world Steel Justice is meant to convey.
All right. Well, we'll try and again. We're going to try and keep this brief because we'll be here for next Saturday. But essentially, Steel Justice is about this lead character, John Steele, who, yes, he is a Vietnam War veteran who has finding it a little difficult to adjust back to life after Vietnam, very quick to anger. Apparently, he was on the police force at one point, but when we meet him again after a brief introduction in Vietnam, he is basically wrangling horses. Essentially, he and his best friend, Lee, who served in Vietnam together, Lee kind of comes and bails him out of the drink tank after he gets in a little trouble. But Lee, of course, has run afoul of the Vietnamese mafia, which apparently was a big thing in the 80s in Southern California. At least the writer of this screenplay felt that they needed to have some kind of social message about the Vietnamese mafia. So,
oh, that was world news.
Yes. Yeah. So General Quan, who both Lee and Steele knew in Vietnam and is kind of a bad guy, is mm-hmm. back. He and his son, and they're kind of running a drug trade in, I'm guessing it's L.A. It could be somewhere in Southern California. It's really kind of not really stated as to where they are. I think it says California, so that's all you need to know, West Coast. And
right.
So Lee's family is attacked, and a lot of people die, And therefore, John Steele, who is a ticking time bomb as it is, needs to live up to the title of the movie and exact some Steele justice. And it won't be too much of a spoiler to say that he does exact some Steele justice, but along the way, there's a lot of shenanigans, some
unintentional.
There's just scene after scene that defies belief. I mean, you really need to see it to believe it, and we would hope that you go seek it out. It has been on Netflix. It's not now, but I think you can watch the whole thing on YouTube. So if you appreciate horrible movies like The Room, Birdemic, anything along those lines, you will find this movie entertaining.
Absolutely. It's one of the best films of all time. My synopsis real quick is a shirtless guy who wears a snake around his neck who is able to get up and walk away from being shot in the ass 12 times at close range.
Without limping, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Basically just wanders around aimlessly throughout the film. I mean, that's kind of what I saw.
Not to get too deep, but I'm gonna strap on my water wings and just jump into the deep end here and talk about the hero's journey, which is a very basic story trope. You know, you've got your heroic character. I'm guessing that's supposed to be John Steele in this movie.
Well, because he just basically allows everyone else to die.
This guy is not. He's not afraid to punch anyone in the face. His wife, actually, I don't think he punches his wife in the face. He does shoot her with a sandbag.
He shoots his wife with a sandbag. He punches a police officer or two.
Yeah, he is, you know, there's no person that he won't, you know, chuck a fist at, a mop handle, a broom, whatever he's got handy. But, you know, in the hero's journey, you've got your main character who comes from somewhere and faces an obstacle, and that kind of tests his mettle, and he probably falters and fails, and at some point along the way, during the journey, he learns from the obstacles in front of him and maybe some past mistakes, and he emerges victorious at the end. And I would argue that John Steele as a character does not change at all throughout the running time of this film, would make sense since his name is John Steele, and like steel forged and hardened, this guy is not going to change, and he basically makes every other character adapt to him continuously and forever and ever. Amen. Godspeed.
Well, and speaking of steel's inflexibility, if you will, as steel, let's talk a little bit about what a hero usually means to people. I mean, obviously, there's been a ton of superhero movies. And when we think of hero, what do we think of as far as physicality of somebody, usually?
Well, if you're talking 80s action movie, you've got your Chuck Norris's, your Jean-Claude Van Damme's, Sylvester Stallone.
And what do they all share? What do those guys all share? They're physically fit. All of them. Right? I mean, physically fit. Athletic.
Yep.
Athletic. You know, able to move around, it's believable, you know, when they're doing something physical. And I don't know if it's Martin Cove or the direction, I don't know what happened in this film, but this guy cannot even throw a punch. I mean, you could put a four-year-old in a film in front of a camera, and they would throw a better punch at one of those air boppy things than this guy threw in the whole entire movie. And he's supposed to be, this is like the follow-up to him being a sensei in Karate Kid. He's not even, you know, one of the extras. He's the sensei in it. I mean,
and it's not as if he's not physically fit. I mean, his, you know, he's shirtless, and even when he does have a shirt, like the sweat stains on him, you can see some definition. Like, he's not, you know, he's not an out of shape guy.
Right.
But yeah, it's crazy.
What is happening?
I don't know.
What is happening?
I likened it, you know, and this goes specifically to, like, the big climactic scene when it's Steele fighting General Kwan at the end. And the choreography was reminding me of Jim Carrey doing the slow motion replay in Ace Ventura. Not in slow motion. It was it couldn't have been more telegraphed if there was a ship sinking at sea and someone was given the SOS.
Part of that is direction, because they show General Kwan jumps up on this like rafter. It's like an elevator thing, and
like
they show
it's
it
like
way
a loading
soon.
Dock.
Loading dock. Yeah,
canvas and they, something.
Yeah, and they show it way too early in the scene. So basically, you see him get on. It's slowly moving off the ground, and you're sitting there watching, and you're watching, and you're watching. And all of a sudden, because they showed this thing way too early, John Steele comes running in, and like I think he realized that this thing's at his knees, and he could basically just take a step up onto it, but just stands there, like looking at it, waits about 5 seconds, then does this like jump up to grab it, and it's barely like higher than his shoulders at that point.
I think, and you know, I think you hear a lot of times when actors are doing scenes that, you know, actors make choices. And I would say that Martin Cove's choice was to wait 30 seconds for the lift to get high enough so that he would actually have to jump on it. Of course, right. The editor involved in this film must have been asleep at that point, mm-hmm. because none of this is ever cut out. It's just kind of happening. And this is supposed to be the big climactic scene of the – I was almost called it a film. Kind of mm-hmm. reserved film to things that don't actually – I don't know where I was going with that, but this is a movie as opposed to a film, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And if you do, well, please write me, because I have no idea right now.
Well, it just, this movie just totally warps your mind, as you know, when it comes to films and movies, and the fact that somebody took a big chunk of change out of their pocket and said, yeah, I'll back that film. You know, again, does this movie have the worst punch from an action star, or maybe just anyone, of all time in film history? Does it have the worst punch?
I don't know if it's the worst. Most hysterical. It may even grab all of the top five, just for that jail fight scene.
Yeah, there is a jail fight scene. I don't want to ruin it at all, but it puts any fight scene in close quarters that I've ever seen to shame. I mean, it is the funniest damn fight scene I have ever seen in my life. I don't even know what to say about it. You have to see this movie just to see that scene. I mean, there's just random mops and weapons brought into it. There's you know, there's a guy twice the size of Steel that he takes down. There's punching people out who are offering him cigarettes. I don't even know where to begin with this scene. I could just watch that scene all day long and just be happy. It is so inane. I can't believe it.
This movie, and at this point I've seen it close to 10 times, I think, and it never fails to make me laugh out loud watching it. And every time you pick up something new that you didn't notice the last time. It's a real treasure trove of comedy, unintentional, and
Treasure trove of Martin Cove.
Yep, it's
Sorry,
a treasure cove.
Just, oh. Yeah, very good. Ooh, yeah. Let's coin that.
I think we have ourselves a new Martin Tweet Cove em. Vehicle.
Tweet him. Tweet him. All right, well, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back with a word from our sponsor, because podcasts, while they're free, are not free, my friends.
I can't believe we got a sponsor.
I don't really understand. I don't really understand what I meant by that. This podcast is free. Why do we need a sponsor?
It's probably because of my alcoholism.
Oh, okay. Sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break here, and we'll hear a word from whoever our sponsor is.
You know who likes hats? You do. You know who also likes hats? Sylvester Stallone. Here's Fedora Sam's Haberdashery.
Yeah, like when I'm walking around and sometimes I wear something like, because it gets cold when you're beating up the beef, and you know what I'm saying? And Paulie wore a hat, and like Mickey, he did sometimes. Adrian, I think, maybe when it was cold or something. So, you know, throw something on your head and get out there and just make something of yourself. Is that good?
We sure do know what you're saying, Sly. Fedora Sam's Haberdashery, 16th and Main. It'll knock you out. Hello, my friend. It is Yuri. I am sitting here in the basement of a house in Smolensk, Russia, and I'm to tell you about my new Russian mail-order bride business. You send me $50 American in mail, and then I, in turn, in mail, stuff one of my mail order brides sitting next here. Beautiful women. I also send, if you act now, one potato in mail with bride. Is so good, it leave you smile happy like clown. So you... I get very excited. I'm very sorry. So you come, you join partnership with Yuri, you get mail order bride. Is so much fun. I hope she make it through a plane ride to your home where you can enjoy many hours of sexy time with bride and whatever you want to do with potato, you do. You peel, you soak in vodka, you'll have party. So you know, listen to Yuri, order mail order bride, and smile happy like clown.
And we are back. If that commercial doesn't pay the bills, then we got some problems. Because that was talent.
All of a sudden, I've got this just strange desire to go out and buy a hat.
Yeah, I know. My freaking head is itching right now. And anyway.
It's probably a climate change. There's something to do with it.
Yeah, so what were we talking about?
Steel Justice. Is it making
the
grade?
Yeah, making the grade.
Well, we're gonna tell you in a little bit. We're going to save that for the end. But... Let's get into a little bit about who John Steele is. Let's tell people about this character here. I attest that John Steele is America, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, quick to strike, punches people, borderline mm-hmm. alcoholic. He sweats like a hot yoga loving meth addict. Mm-hmm. He's got a bizarre erotic fixation with his best friend's daughter and possibly mm-hmm. grandmother.
He wears a snake like it's nobody's business.
Yep. The guy, he's an exercise nut, preferably shirtless on a beach with a mop.
Mm-hmm.
If that doesn't mm-hmm. say America, don't know what does.
And one more thing you're leaving out about America.
The A?
If you happen to jump through a window and get, you know, a really bad cut, just hope that it's over to a buffet line so that you can, you know, cauterize the wound with the frying pan.
I mean, if
that doesn't scream America, I don't know what does.
Well, I mean, you know, that's an excellent point because that scene in particular, John Steele gets hit with a poison dart in the middle of a mall as he's blowing up a music video. And he immediately sees that there's a little buffet, but rather than walk through the entrance, he leaps through a glass window.
Well, he is dying of poison, so I mean, he has to leap through a glass window.
Well,
right?
Because that's what Americans do.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
He quickly uses a knife, cuts open the wound, sucks out the poison, and cauterizes it with a frying pan. So
yeah, textbook,
easy peasy, nice as you please. He's all fixed up and ready to go on to the next scene.
Yeah, but who hasn't learned that in health class?
Not me.
So, yeah. So, who is John Steele? I mean, you hit pretty much everything about the man that is just beautiful. I mean, he can go from laying in a filthy dirt bath to shirtless with a pink sweater wrapped around his neck. And it's just, you know, he has so much range.
And, I mean, in the history of bathtub nude scenes... mm-hmm. You will never find a more dirty tub of water than when John Steele is in Lee's home trying to wash himself clean of his day's activities. I mean, that tub is filthy.
I mean, it is like darker than the deepest Frappuccino at Starbucks that you can buy. I mean, I do not understand. I mean, was that his first bath after the war? Like, I don't understand. That's so much dirt.
It's entirely possible. I mean, you know, he might have taken Vietnam back with him. I mean, John and I have been to the Guinness Brewery. Loch Ness has more visibility mm-hmm. looking down into it than this tub did after John Steele laid himself down in it.
I mean, honestly, I mean... Either it was an effort to cover up the nudity or something, or just what. But, I mean, the guy's in the tub, washing it down, and just there's just complete filth coming off him. And yet he feels the need to still submerge himself completely underwater while his friend's family is basically being annihilated outside by the mafia.
And by washing it down, John, of course, means John Steele's penis. Yes.
Down, meaning down below.
Downward swipes of the washcloth.
Yes. But, I mean, it was hard to keep the movie on after that. I was a little bit grossed out for a few minutes. I felt like a grittiness in my teeth or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I felt dirty.
Yeah, it's like being like a day at the beach. It gets in every possible crevice and orifice, and you can't really get it out. That's how dirty John Steele is.
And for being almost superhero-like, the man is unable to hear about 2,000 rounds of machine guns while he's submerged in the tub for maybe what should have been about 5 seconds, but seemed like an eternity.
Super hearing is not one of John Steele's traits. I think regular human hearing is also not one of John Steele's traits.
No. No. But what he lacks in punch skill and cleanliness and, decision making about jumping through windows when he's been hit with a poison dart, he makes up because he has a secret weapon. He has, I wouldn't even call him a mascot. He's really his boy wonder, if you will.
I thought you were going to talk about his secret weapon being his ability to be, like, super creepy into his best friend's daughter. But, yeah, we can get into that after.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another skill that he possesses that is really second to none.
That could be his best skill. But this is not really his skill. Well, it sort of is, because he's sort of the Dr. Doolittle, able to communicate with the animals. And he could, kind of control his partner at will.
This is true. And his really his best friend, other than Lee, who gets killed.
Because he's taking the dirt bath.
Yep. And he's taking a literal one. Is his friend Three Step, which is a snake, apparently mm-hmm. a very poisonous snake, that if it bites you, you're dead within three steps, hence the name Three Step.
Although you have to yell out and call out each
yes.
step, though.
Yes, because yeah. you have to gauge the person's pace. Like if Three Step bites a 5-year-old as opposed mm-hmm. to like a 35-year-old, you're, right. you know. John Steele seems to know that he's got like, he's on a special wavelength with Three Step. The character Three Step. Let's separate the character Three Step from the actual snake Three Step, who it is clear in this film wants to get as far away from Martin Cove's sweaty, dirty neck as physically possible. And snakes, they're kind of known for like slithering on the ground and in the dirt. This snake, I'm sure whoever its agent was, got reamed out pretty hard by the snake for being in this film. You can tell he wants no part. No part of that sweaty, dirty, filthy animal, John Steele.
Well, we all know what happened in the 1930s in Hollywood with the whole discrimination thing against snakes and having vocal parts in films, and that was culminated once again with Kermit the Frog having so many lines in his films, but yet snakes were, until really Harry Potter came along and they're speaking another language. They really haven't had a lot of speaking roles. So this snake obviously, comes on the set, thinks it's going to be a big deal. And he's, basically second fiddle and turns into some kind of handkerchief for John Steele for most of the film.
Albeit a nice colorful one when you're, you're stealthily moving through the, quote, Vietnamese, a.k.a. some park in California jungle, and you want to be camouflaged, what you really want to have is a bright red and yellow and black snake around your neck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I feel bad for the snake, without a doubt.
Although, you know,
I look back, he wore it fashionably many different times in the film. Sometimes he looked so handsome with the snake on. I forgot if we were watching an action movie or some kind of documentary runway model kind of thing, but it was, the snake definitely plays an important role in the film.
And, now that I think about it, the snake is probably thinking, I need to camouflage myself by kind of laying on some piece of wood, and you could probably describe Martin Cove's acting as slightly wooden, so in the snake's mind, maybe he thought that he was really actually doing a service to the scene. This speaks more to, and I hate to bring this up because, we don't try to court controversy on making a grade, but, you brought up the 20s and 30s, and I mean, this is just the unwritten tragedy of Hollywood that snakes mm-hmm. were just unable to adapt to when silent pictures became talkies.
Oh, and also the whole and the whole prohibition thing. But I mean, I don't want to just, you know, beat a dead snake or a dead horse, whatever. Everybody knows the story, so.
Right, and we know that snakes can't hold their liquor. That was established in the McGovern report in 1912. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all common knowledge. Well, we're not saying anything that no one doesn't know.
Well, and then you had the whole thing with Elliot Ness.
Mm.
You know, and the rum running thing. So, but whatever. I mean, that's neither here nor there. We know where we've been, and we're not sure where we're going, and that's the question.
And that's really always the case. Is we never really know where we're going, and it usually
quick tangent.
Yes.
Quick tangent. I got two quick questions for you.
Oh, I love questions.
General Kwan.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to answer these questions for me, based on the character of General Kwan. All right, if he is your model of just exceptionalism. Okay. If you were going to creep out your future girlfriend, your son, and some other thugs that were in the room, what would you come down the stairs wearing?
Probably a banana hammock.
Okay. wait. Option two, though, if you think the actual film, you're coming down the stairs. You want to, you know, everybody expects you to come down in some kind of gi or something really dominant. You're the leader of this gang and this whole force, and your son is there. You're trying to set an example, and you know later on your future girlfriend. What would you be wearing if you'd come down the steps?
Oh, when you put it that way, I would come down in a flowery, flowing kimono.
Yeah, that's in this film. So I mean, it's very important to discuss these things and you know really wet the whistle of the listener, if you will, about you know watching Steel Justice, because that's a real thing in this movie.
Oh, it is a real thing, and it is really disturbing. But not the most disturbing thing in this film.
No, what is the most disturbing?
And
thing
I said
in this
film, and I said I wouldn't call it a film. So, damn it.
And we're getting to our final wrap up here shortly. But give me what the most disturbing thing is in the film.
Yeah, and we couldn't let you all go without bringing this up. Is that there is a really strong undercurrent? I'm talking like a riptide of eroticism involving John Steele and Cammy, who is Lee's daughter. And
basically Steele's niece.
Yes.
It is disgusting. I don't know. I don't know if it's intentional or unintentional, or they were trying so hard to show that they were close and cared about each other. But when they are on camera together, I literally have to look away.
Woo.
It is so creepy.
Intense. Yes. Yes. And to make matters worse, Cammy and the actress that plays her, I don't know how old she was when they filmed this. She could have been late teens, early 20s, but
yeah, let's say 19 or something like that. Yeah, definitely.
But she's dressed up in this movie kind of like Alyssa Milano's character in Commando. She's like the Asian stunt double of Alyssa Milano in Commando. Like, she's got like pigtails and overalls. Like, she's dressed like a 12-year-old, which
and
makes
she acts
it
like a 6-year-old.
Yeah, she talks with like this really high pitched lisp, and if that's really how that the actress speaks, then I feel really shame right now for even bringing it up. But it just adds to the creep factor, and Martin Cove does nothing to dispel it. Throughout every scene they're in, it's hey pumpkin, hey kitty cat, hey love of my life, and he even gives the grandmother a wink at one point. So
yeah, he gives the grandma a wink. I mean, it's just
who in that family is John Steele not sleeping with?
Whoever he let die, basically, because he's just freaking taking his dirt bath. But I mean, that's it. Otherwise, he would sleep with anyone. Throw them all in the tub. He doesn't care.
And the Cammy is just she is. And again, I think this is just the writers be like, we've got to show this guy having some emotion and that he cares about someone, because clearly, like, his ex-wife, played by Celia Ward in this movie, he barely can tolerate her, and you know, but still ends up with her at the end, even though he's basically wrecked her career because she's a, you know, apparently a hot stuff music video director, but he basically annihilates the entire set. So her career is shot by the end of this movie. And
so are some of her assistants, by the way.
Yes, to the point of, you know, non-resuscitation going on there. So John Steele wrecks pretty much everything for everyone. He's unemployable. his ex-wife, who is now on his side, is unemployable. They're going to bank on Cammy, who, I guess, you know, does a little classical piano. They're going to hope that she becomes some kind of child prodigy and is paying the bills. And that's the only way that this movie, you know, as credits start rolling, that's the only hope that they have for any kind of happy ending.
And we don't have enough time to get into some of the other big-name actors and how they contributed or didn't contribute to this film. There were some big-name actors in this film, though, that went on to do some, you know, great work or did some great work before. And again, I don't know if this is calling in a favor or something. The police chief from Beverly Hills Cop. What's his name, Pete?
Ronnie Cox.
Oh, Ronnie Cox. Very good actor. Very good actor.
Bernie Casey is in this. We mentioned
great
Cecil
actor.
Ward.
Yep.
The General Kwan is not, you would recognize him. He was like the bad guy. Well, I think he always plays a bad guy in the 80s, but he was in one of the Chuck Norris Missing in Action movies. I think it was the second one where he plays like the prison camp leader guy.
And I think his son is the bad guy in the Karate Kid 2, so there's another Karate Kid tie-in here.
Yep.
With Sensei.
Hell, the woman that played Ursa in Superman 2 is in it for like 30 seconds as a lawyer. I mean,
yeah,
these people must have, I don't know, people must have had a rent payment or something that they needed, that they agreed to be in this piece of shit movie. But again, I say that with love because I really do.
Yeah.
I actually love this movie.
Yeah, we love Steel Justice. You will too. You need to go check it out. It's free to find somewhere, as this podcast is free. You know, we hope that you join us each week for Making the Grade. Sometimes we will even give a score. Pete, when we were younger, we had this one teacher who used to score our social studies grades out of just random numbers. So, like, out of a 412, what would you give Steel Justice?
This is a solid 385 on the Art Elin scale.
Yeah, so that makes the grade. I mean, we don't have a specific criteria. But, you know, obviously it makes the grade. So check out Steel Justice. You know, just be prepared for the dirt bath and be prepared for the uncomfortable scenes with the niece. But otherwise, just get a few friends together on the couch, you know, grab a few drinks, throw your arm around each other, you know, and just have a good grand old time.
Celebrate America. You owe it to yourself. And you owe it to Martin Cove because he could really use the love. And you can follow Martin Cove on Twitter. He is on Twitter. I think it's Real Martin Cove. So drop him a line. We'd love to talk to him too. So just give him some love for this movie. You can't find much information on it anywhere, and that's a shame because it is really just absolutely flat out hysterical. And in our books, it definitely makes the grade.
Yeah, and remember, folks, the only way to get the grade is to make the grade.
And with that, we will leave you until our next episode, where we will find some other equally interesting, inane, insane, and altogether fascinating topic. And we will discuss whether if it too, in fact, makes the grade on Making the Grade.
See you next time.